the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the cost of a college education can often be vexing for a parent. A public education can cost $20,000 or more, and a private education can run anywhere from $40,000 to over $60,000 a year. Daunting costs when you consider, especially if you have more than one or two children you have to educate. Joining me on the program today is Robert Franek. He's co-author of a book called Colleges That Pay You Back, the 200 schools that give you the best bang for your tuition. Robert, before we get into schools and criteria, I wonder if you could just go through how you evaluate a college, the various things you look at in terms of rating, because as I went through your book, it is really quite comprehensive.
Well, I thank you very much, Jim, and it's good to be back on your show. I so appreciate it. And for that book, and I do several different books, I'm editor-in-chief for the Princeton Review, but I still write a couple of college admission research guidebooks, two of which focus solidly either on financial aid or return on your investment, and that's both students' academic investment as well as they and their family's financial investment. But specifically for colleges that pay you back, a new issue just came out in the last week in January, so the data is still so fresh. There are seven different ranking lists in that book, you know, some of which, you know, when we created the book, we said, but listen, we want to make sure that these have great utility for students and parents and counselors helping them along the way, so we focused on schools for the best internships, best career placement, best alumni networks. So things that I spend the majority of my time on the road throughout the academic year visiting colleges and then spending time at high schools and talking to students and parents and, of course, with school counselors. And these are the things that those students and parents have been asking us about, and we did the homework at Princeton Review and put together those ranking lists.
When you take a look at a college, I'm just trying to put this in perspective from a parent and, let's say, a potential child. What are the most important things in your view when you look at a college? Obviously, there's the cost, but it's also what kind of education you're going to get, in my mind. And also, if, let's say, I want to specialize in a special type of degree, let's say I want to go into engineering, you know, who are the best engineering schools? What are the most important things you think a parent and child should look at when looking at a potential college?
And there are the big four, we call them, at the Princeton Review, and on how to sort of winnow down that either list of schools or just to be, you know, substantive in the kind of discussion that you're having, if you're a student having with your parents or a student themselves having it with their parents or counselors, or certainly when you get onto a college campus. So even if we could just look at the criteria that we started with for colleges that pay you back, and we winnowed at those 200 schools that are profiled in the book from 2,000 schools, and I think this is a good sort of rule of thumb for every student and parent going through the college research process. One, as you had pointed out, this school has to be a great academic fit for a student. So that was our first, you know, criteria for the book. This has to be a compelling place academically. A student in the classroom has to feel that they are in that right spot and challenged in that environment. But number two, we looked at raw sticker costs. And this is total cost of attendance, right? So tuition, room and board, fees, books. So no blinders going into the process. So if, you know, University of Southern California in your neck of the woods is, you know, just over $70,000 this year, we want to make sure that we're calling out that school for what the sticker cost is. But the third bucket is making sure that we call out how aggressively those schools with either lofty sticker costs or more reasonable sticker costs, but how are they offsetting those sticker costs with financial aid, scholarship dollars, merit-based grants, money that students don't have to pay back to make that either lofty or sticker cost affordable for the average student and family. And then the fourth bucket, and this is so important, is what are students doing through a career development and career service channel? So are they getting internships, co-ops, experiential learning, you know, whatever the nomenclature is that a particular school uses, and it does differ from school to school. But what are students doing outside the classroom, tethered to the work that they're doing actually academically in the classroom? Are they getting those sort of internships and co-ops? And then are they attractive to employers upon graduation because of both their academic work in the classroom and their outside of the work through experiential learning channels? So I think those are really four things, and those are big buckets, but I do think that they're valuable for a student and parent in high school going through the process now.
You know, Robert, you brought up something that I find very important, that is internships. For example, at my own company, we work with the local junior college providing internships for their students, and they get paid at the same time. So the students can find out if the field that they plan to study is really the field they want to go into, but also pick up valuable work experience so that when they graduate, they can go to their employer. In some cases, we've actually hired some of these interns, but go to their employer and say, not only do I have a degree in education, but I have 4 years of internship working in the field. Are you seeing more colleges move in that direction to help in the placement of their students upon graduation?
Without question, the answer to that is yes and yes, right? Because we understand, and we've done the homework through the Princeton Review channel, to make sure that we are, one, surveying those schools to find out what sorts of internships, career development opportunities students have as young undergraduates, and does that experience exist throughout their 4 years as an undergraduate at a particular college or university. But what I'm hearing, and I know when we spoke in the past, Jim, I probably said this as well, that I visit more college campuses than I am convinced any other person on the planet. So when we think about it from a quantitative perspective, it's a lot of schools. But if I don't hear from either an admission counselor or admission dean or college president when I'm visiting campus, talking to me about what those career development services are, what are those internships and co-ops and experiential learning opportunities that a student has, if I don't hear that in the first 15 minutes of our conversation, then I'm suspect. And my guidance to students and parents going through the college research process now is they should be as suspect and as, I think, savvy about asking those questions, because schools worth their value academically and otherwise should be providing those things for you in their own sort of, you know, pitch about their school, but you should see that in the experience that you have on campus and when you're interacting with students and faculty and so on.
I know some schools have endowments, they have scholarships, some schools have, let's say, work programs. How important is that when you're looking at a college? And especially, I would think, Robert, when you're looking at a private college where the cost can run from $40,000 to $60,000. I know one of the interns that is with us now is looking at a private college that's going to run him close to $65,000 a year.
Yeah, and I totally hear it. And, you know, the universe of schools out there, it's, as you say, $20,090 on average to attend 1 year of public college, average across the state. That's in-state tuition for a student, but that's averaged across the states. For four-year private schools, for 1 year of college at a private school, it's $45,370, right? But there are many schools in the universe of schools that are charging that, you know, $55,000, $65,000, $70,000+. So we understand that the cost of college is heart-stoppingly expensive at $45,000 or $70,000. But, and I do think it's a couple of metrics just for students and parents to keep in their head. The average discount rate, now we can call that scholarships, we can call it grants, we can call it discounting, is this year 49.1%, which means there are certainly students that are going to pay, you know, the $70,000 sticker cost here at NYU in my hometown, but there are many students that will likely not pay that amount because of either, one, academic prowess, you know, how well they've done in high school, how well they've done on the SAT and the ACT, actively giving out scholarship dollars to attract that, you know, sort of awesome renaissance student to our school, you know, and giving out grants and scholarship based on financial need from a student and their family. But it's good to know almost 50% of the average four-year college is discounting that amount. So you're right. There are endowment dollars towards that. There are simply enrollment management tools that a dean of admission and VP of enrollment management can use to attract students to them. And that is often giving out scholarships or significantly discounting. The words are interchangeable. I just think that schools outwardly, the students and parents will call it scholarships. You know, to us, it's discounting their sticker cost to make it affordable for the average student and family.
Now, when you look at this, you know, I think when it comes to applying to, let's say, a private institution, let's say you're looking at Stanford, Harvard, Brown, or some of the big schools like that, you know, a lot of times some parents, depending on their income, let's say I'm a parent and between husband and wife are making over $100,000, a lot of parents don't think of applying for financial aid because they think that because of their income, they don't qualify. Can you address that issue when it comes to these colleges? Because I think they're a lot more open to some kind of aid for students, because I think most colleges recognize today when you're charging $40,000 to $65,000 that, you know, there's not too many people around that have that kind of spare change.
Sure, sure. And the truth is that students and families, parents specifically, that, you know, say, listen, we've been blessed, we're doing well financially, we're not going to apply for financial aid because we feel that whatever our income is, it's probably far above where we could qualify for aid. It is the tragic flaw, and we see it often through the families that we work with at Princeton Review, of saying, listen, I'm not going to apply for financial aid, I make too much money, without doing the due diligence of actually filling out the FAFSA form, and the acronym stands for the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. If you don't apply for it through the FAFSA form, then you're certainly not going to receive any aid. And it's something that's so avoidable. Now, the FAFSA form is really no fun to fill out, but it is available to students and parents because it will be that first, you know, sort of foray into applying for financial aid. And it's just a simple and fairly straightforward form. Now, we do a lot of advising for that on the Princeton Review side of the fence, how to actually complete that form to the best of your ability. But yeah, you have to fill it out, because now that will qualify a student for, it could be grants based on a family's need. It could be a subsidized loan or an unsubsidized loan by the government, but you have to apply for it to receive that. I beat that point down, but it's a good one to make.
When you're taking a look at, is there any level of income that there's just no way that something's going to happen? I know that I've got clients who have substantial income whose children have gone on to college and gotten scholarships either because of academic merit or because of athletic abilities.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you brought it up. And I'm hesitant to say if you make over, you know, this dollar amount, don't apply for financial aid, because there are so many different nuances, you know, when thinking about those things. If a family is recently divorced, if you have two or three students in school and college at the same time, suppose one of the spouses loses a job, you know, either before a student applies to college or, you know, while they're in college. The truth is that things change about our lives financially as adults that will reflect, and it could be a benefit to us from a financial aid perspective. But for those things to be, you know, corralled, we have to figure out what those things are, and we corral them onto that FAFSA form so that it could benefit us and our students. So in thinking about just the whole umbrella of financial aid, I think it's good for your listeners to know, certainly there is financial aid based on academic merit, right? And that is the work that students are doing. And I address students, you know, near nightly in high schools and colleges across the country. And what I say is, if you're a student in high school and you're listening to my voice, your job is to be awesome in high school, right? Your job is to do well academically, to challenge yourself to the best of your ability in high school. And then two, is to perform well in the SAT and the ACT. You know, those are unfair exams. I've been a longtime teacher for both exams. We're 4,000 teachers at the Princeton Review for both. But the thing is, they're masterable exams. They're absolutely navigable exams. But cross those two metrics together, and it unlocks academic admission at many schools, and then scholarship dollars based on how smart you are and how well you performed on the standardized tests, right? So that's just the academic prowess, academic merit, and there are scholarship dollars available for students just because they've performed well. And that second bucket is that based on financial need, and that's, just, again, through the FAFSA form. There are some supplemental financial aid applications for a few schools called the CSS profile, but you'll figure that out, and then certainly we guide students, you know, about this on our website as well. But anyway, so that second bucket is based on financial need from a student and their family. But that's the easiest way to think about financial aid, based on academic merit and prowess, and then based on financial need.
Now, another issue I want to talk about, let's say that you're a parent and you have a child that has a particular interest in pursuing a certain kind of a degree. Let's say it's engineering or it's medical school. Are there certain colleges that are better, let's say they specialize in that area, or they're known for their expertise, let's say in engineering? And Robert, I guess the second question is, if there are several colleges that meet that criteria, that they specialize in that field, does it make a difference to a potential employer that if you graduate, let's say you graduate with good grades, that you come out of, let's say, a public college versus, let's say, Harvard?
Here's the easiest way to break it down. And I am often asked this question, you know, Rob, what's the best school for, you know, engineering, or what's the best school, you know, for psychology or biology? And we try to break this down in some sensible ways for students. I don't rank those schools, but I do put out sort of just good guidance on schools of distinction in that book that you had kindly mentioned before, Colleges That Pay You Back. We have, in the front matter of that book, and this is also available on our website as well, you know, just looking at electrical engineering in general, you know, we have a list of schools, and it's a substantial list of schools, public and private, large and small, urban, suburban, and rural, so thinking about what that fit is going to be. And then where I think it's really helpful is putting in, what we slugged in was the median starting salary for electrical engineers, and then the median career salary for electrical engineers, right? So just what you can expect to earn upon graduation from college, and that what you can expect to earn 10 or 15 years into your career. And I love putting in those kind of metrics because it just gives students and parents in high school that much more information into saying, you know, what is the typical, what's my life going to be like from a compensation standpoint over my career, but what can I expect when I get out of school? Now, to answer your question on, I think it's a brand question, right? So is there a better brand value to me as a student if I go to an Ivy or a near Ivy or a school with great big brand name or my local, you know, public university? And the truth is that, and this isn't a cop-out answer, the truth is that we have to, as students, be able to consciously and confidently answer the question of finding fit, right? If UC San Diego, fabulous school, on many of our lists of distinction at the Princeton Review, is an hour from your home in Southern California, that might be the right fit for you if you've answered the other parts of fit, right? It's got to be a great fit for you academically, from a campus culture perspective, and certainly from a financial aid and career services perspective. Just because we go to an Ivy, right, doesn't guarantee us a successful life. It doesn't guarantee us a successful professional future. Any school is in the business of providing that for you. There are some schools that have a more recognizable brand name, but it doesn't guarantee us that successful future.
Let's say you're applying for your first job out of college. Obviously, if you're coming out of Harvard, Stanford, that looks impressive. But, you know, once you get into your working career, employers look more at what you've accomplished and achieved rather than just your education.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is value to the brand and the heft of that brand, and I think getting students noticed. And I do think that there's an alumni network that can be very, you know, it should be a great benefit for a student throughout their career lifetime. But if you go to a school that's not an Ivy, that doesn't preclude you from allowing for that, for your own brand and your own alumni network and career services to stop. Right? I mean, those things will happen at other schools. I was at University of Houston, which is a personal favorite of mine at the Princeton Review. I was their commencement speaker for their entrepreneurship school on the undergraduate level, fabulous at the school in the University of Houston called the Wolf Center. And these students were the most contagious and electric with energy around what they had studied on entrepreneurship on the undergraduate level. More than half of the students were first-generation college. The largest percent of them were Latina. It's a Hispanic serving institution in general. And these students, Jim, are going to go on to do fabulous things. And this is a large urban university in the city of Houston. And I would put them against any other student at the many, many colleges that we write about at Princeton Review because of their academic experience, their work outside the classroom, their financial aid experience, their career service, all the things that we talked about. I'm ticking them off the list for University of Houston, and I'm putting a, you know, a great big star on their column here at Princeton Review because of that list and that benefit that those students get.
So if we were to, let's say, begin this process, as many parents are right now, if they haven't done it already, because graduation is this month or next month, depending on what school you've gone to, how would you begin the process? In other words, if you could lay forward a step plan, step one, step two, step three, what should parents do?
It's a good question, and one that comes up often through the work that I do on the Princeton Review side of the fence. And I think, you know, is it ever too early to start talking about college? Have I totally missed the ball if I start too late? The truth is, it's never really too early to start having the conversation about college, right? I often talk to students who are, you know, first-year freshmen in high school. And the truth is that if you can introduce the conversation about just talking about college, you know, talking about your own schools, talking about the school down the road from you, talking about the community college in your neighborhood, you know, talking about where your friends, you know, parents or their brothers and sisters go to school. All of those things, in my experience, make students and their parents who are going through the college process or starting the college process that much more savvy, right? Because they are understanding there needn't be any frenzy around college admission. You know, you're diffusing the frenzy when you start to master and talk confidently about colleges. So I think that's the first part to start. I do have, and I hate to be a product pitcher for Princeton Review, but I think a really good beginner book, and it's called The Best 381 Colleges. It's fabulous. Now, it's a kind of a phone book size publication, but why I love it is it's particularly for students that are going through the college process. And we surveyed this year, for this edition of the book, 142,000 current college students, asking them about their academic experience, about their career services experience, about their campus culture experiences. You know, do students actually talk to one another on campus? Is the food good? Is the career services development center up to snuff? You know, those kinds of things I think are incredibly valuable. That's where I would start the process. And the truth is, we have this up on our website. I mean, you can get all this information for free. But it's that information, school-specific, quantitative metrics about their school by SAT and ACT and raw GPA, but then marrying that with student information, students telling us at Princeton Review and us crafting narrative based on that feedback from those 142,000 students about their experiences academically and otherwise. That is an awesome place to start.
You know, Robert, you've put together a lot of great stuff, and I want to highly recommend your book because a lot of parents are looking at schools, and you break down all kinds of criteria that I think can answer a lot of a parent or their child's questions about that particular college, from financial aid to ranking to their specialization, and it's a great book to look at. I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income, and much success with this book. Great, great book, and highly recommend it.
I so appreciate it, Jim. It was good to be back on. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, once again, the name of the book is Colleges That Pay You Back. And I mean, it is absolutely a great book for a parent or a child. If you're really taking a look at colleges, you're not sure which college to choose, everything that you can think of, bang for your buck, financial aid, general information, career, bottom line, and the true financial facts, what that education is going to cost. And once again, the name of the book, Colleges That Pay You Back, by Robert Franek, who's been my guest. In the meantime, as always, we are out of time. This is going to finish up our coverage of education. We wanted to cover this topic extensively this month because it is that time of the year, graduation time. Hope you enjoyed the program. In the meantime, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.